I think the rule should be the Z-axis because they put me to sleep.
Nice.
See what I did there?
Yeah. The math jokes. Dangerous Hall of Mirrors in New York City. I'm your host, Shane.
And I'm your host, Ishan.
And welcome to episode 64 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking it out, discussing narrative control. But first, the party finally listens to Brand in the Morning Glory campaign, and later, the Master Illusionist sets the scene in the Character Creation Forge.
So before we get to that, Dark Sun. Oh my god, we're running Dark Sun.
Finally. Oh, we've been waiting for so long.
I know.
We've been talking about this for like 9 months.
We've been talking about it since before the Morning Glory campaign ended.
Yeah, what do you want to do next? I don't know, Dark Sun?
Yeah. So what are you playing?
I'm playing the build that initially influenced last week's Character Creation Forge, the Swamp Thing. I wanted to play something that I really have had no interest in playing before, which was a druid. But, of course, I always like to subvert character types, so I'm playing a melee druid who starts off as a psychic warrior. I'm reflavoring some cantrips as psionics, because, you know, everybody in Dark Sun has some mild psionic ability.
And everything in 5e has terrible psionics.
Yep, thus far. Pretty soon we're supposed to get 20 levels of the mystic. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Telekinetically.
I'm not even moving these myself! I'm using my mind.
We get it, dude. You vape.
What are you playing?
I am playing a barbarian. I am playing a Goliath barbarian.
So in one of the deadliest settings, you are going to play an up-close and personal melee combatant.
Oh, yeah.
Are you going barbarian?
Oh, no.
Really?
Nope. I'm going battle rager.
Oh. Yep.
Oh, I'm going to be in your face.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he's like the standard bearer for the company.
You're going to get like chitin spike armor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I took proficiency in Smith's tool, so I'm going to forge my own spiked armor. I'm psyched.
You should get taxidermy, because that'll be the same thing in Dark Sun. Because there's no metal, for those of you who don't know the setting.
Yeah, it just has like chitin and bone.
So does that mean that everyone is anemic?
You would think, right? It's your source of iron.
Or molybdenum.
So the setup for our campaign, we're members of a mercenary company, heavily black company inspired. And so we are all members, or at least closely attached to the company. And my character will be the or one of the standard bearers.
Like literally carrying the flag.
Yeah, because I'm a Goliath. So I've got, yeah, you know, like a 1,000,000 pound carrying capacity.
And, you know, it needs to be seen above the fray. And you're literally head and shoulders above the fray.
I'm like 8 feet tall. Yeah. Good point. I'm very light for a Goliath because I want to be able to ride a mount.
Yeah, we were like, you should go maximum height, but minimum weight.
Right. I think I'm somewhere more reasonable than that.
I think this is maybe the first time that we have min-maxed the racial charts for size.
Oh, no. not that. We have min-maxed down to every last gold piece we've spent.
Ceramic piece, I think you mean?
That's true.
I'm also very excited that this is the return of Angelo, who played Bahar in the Morning Glory campaign, as a GM, because he ran our last 4E game before D&D Next came out. That one went all the way from, you know, first level to 30th level.
Yeah, I've never played in a game that he ran.
Oh, you're in for a treat.
I know, I'm super psyched. But let's go back to our old faithful Morning Glory, our 3-year Eberron campaign.
Yeah, we're finally creeping up on the end of that. The party is now conducting the final steps so that they can confront Bel Shaelor, the Shadow in the Flame, the fiendish overlord who is currently infecting one of the major religions in the world. And they've got to find a way to prevent him from regathering all of the most powerful forces in existence so that he can recreate the multiverse in his own image.
So, to that end, we have recently discovered the true name of his Proktu, the Rakshasas that serve the overlords, summoned him and defeated him and forced him to give us the name of Bel Shaelor so that we may kill him once and for all.
And Bel Shaelor's name is currently residing inside a prophetic apparatus that the party has constructed from a wide variety of strange and exotic materials.
A wide variety of strange and exotic fetch quests. Old dead overlords, actually.
And avatars of ideas.
Right.
It is currently held within a tattoo on Lu, the Great Old One Warlock's forehead, and she's paying a price for it. She is spending a hit die every hour to maintain it.
So we're in a hurry.
Yeah, you don't have much time. You also know that Kyber Seth is just a day away when the force that keeps all of the fiendish overlords deep in the Underdark in Kyber is at its weakest. And the days of long shadows are actually just a few hours away when the power of the shadow and the flame is at its highest.
So we did have a trick up our sleeve back in Thronehold, where King Caius and his aunt
Miralla
had attempted to betray the party, assassinate us, cause chaos, apparently under the direction of Arandis Vol. We had discovered a signet ring that High Cardinal Crozen was wearing. Bran had taken it and sort of slipped it in his pocket. We learned that it had the ability to teleport.
Mm-hmm. A contingent teleport that will bring the bearer and their retinue back to Flamekeep, which is very convenient because right now Flamekeep is totally locked down in preparation for war, so there's really no way to get in.
Even as an Inquisitor, which Bran is.
Right, you have not been recalled.
Right. Turns out they don't want probably the most powerful Inquisitor in the entire church back home for this little betrayal that they're pulling.
Yeah. So the party does need to get there, though, because the ritual that Belshalor is undertaking to begin this entire process of remaking the multiverse, they're pretty sure begins with the prophesied half-elf suicide of Arandis Vol, who they know as Lauren Davis, the false keeper of the flame. She is currently sitting near the flame itself, deep inside Flamekeep, which Brand knows well, if he can just actually get there.
So we start shouting things at a ring, trying to trigger its contingency. Figuring it must be an auditory type thing, because you'd want to choose it. And it didn't trigger when he died, so it couldn't have been related to harm.
Right. So putting their heads together, conducting some magical identifications, and then Brand really using his knowledge of not only the Inquisitors and the church itself, but Crozen himself, whom you had never met in person?
No, but we had a fraught relationship either way.
Right, both of you knew of each other, and Crozen certainly his reputation preceded him.
Yeah.
He was eminently practical. He liked to have things exactly his way.
As the High Cardinal of Thrain, he was effectively the non-religious head of state.
Yeah, exactly.
Despite the fact that he was actually a member of the church.
Well, it is a theocracy.
It's a very much a theocracy, yeah.
With some experimentation, the party stumbles upon what obviously is the trigger for the spell. Simply saying, while wearing the ring, I am Martell Crozen, and I want to return home.
Makes sense.
I think the most difficult part of that was actually figuring out his name.
His first name, yeah.
The Hammer. His parents named him after a hammer. Of course he was going to be tough. And so, the party appears in Flamekeep, in the castle itself, inside High Cardinal Crozen's chambers.
Great. Let's start going through his stuff.
That's exactly what they did. Now, they had found Crozen's notes that he had brought with him to Thronehold and discovered that he was actually suspicious of who exactly Lauren Davis was. He had sort of done the different acronyms and come up with Arandis Vol, who the party knew was actually a half-elf, half-dragon, who was 3,000 years old and had been sort of guiding a cult of followers in trying to amass control over different types of undeath.
So through his encoded journal, we discovered the sequence of events, that Jayla was being kept in the Stone Ward.
Right, Jayla Darren, the actual keeper of the flame.
That Crozen believed the flame was telling him that Jayla Darren wasn't strong enough to lead Thrain through the upcoming crisis.
And relatively recently, Jayla had made friends with a young half-elven girl named Lauren Davis, who had presented an affinity for dealing with the flame. And Crozen had thought, you know what? She seems more malleable. She seems like she's capable of doing what I need her to do. And then we will be able to, once she is in power, lead Thrain through the crisis that is coming.
Which really paints Crozen as this sort of tragic hero, right?
He did it for the greater good, yes?
Right. I mean, he made a mistake here, but he did it for the right reasons. And up to this point, Bran's relationship with him pretty much had painted him as the willful betrayer of the Silver Flame.
Now, if you think about it, Crozen's real failing was that he wasn't suspicious enough of his own god, right? When Brand found out that the rumors were true about the flame being infiltrated by Belshaler, that Belshaler has some influence over people who speak to the flame.
Well, that the heresy of the flame was true.
Right. Brand didn't just ignore it and say, oh no, that can't be true. Now, Crozen had to have known about this heresy, right? Like, it's called a heresy because the church disavows it, but they know that it exists. Mm-hmm. If he had actually put stock in it and had said, why is the flame telling me to do this? Why is it that this girl who came from nowhere seemingly can communicate very well with the flame? He may have not necessarily walked into such a trap.
But, c'est la vie. He paid the price.
Now he's dead. He did learn the identity of the actual Grand Confessor of the Silver Flame, the head of the Inquisition, Malak Othero, also head of the Argentum, which tasks people with retrieving magical artifacts.
Which actually was new for me as a player, because I had thought that Crozen was actually the head of the Inquisition.
Yeah, no one knew, right? Grand Confessor always wears a mask.
I mean, traditionally.
At this point, the party, after essentially ransacking Crozen's chambers, decides that the next place they need to go is Nistrum's chambers. Because remember, Nistrum Shadar, who was actually the proctu for Belshalor, was masquerading for many years as an inquisitor.
Yes.
And so they dress themselves as people who really belong in Flamekeep and stealthily make their way to a separate wing on the other side of the nave, where they know that Nistrum's chambers actually are. And they sneak into his room, carefully making sure that they disable the trap of combination silence fireball.
Yes, so we had finally learned, after multiple run-ins with Nistrum's booby traps, that he always has a triggered silence and then a triggered fireball.
So that no one hears the explosion and comes to help you.
Right.
And Nistrum is dead, so they go through all of his papers that he had thought had been well guarded. And there are a few things that they discovered that might potentially be useful. Papers that explain that cube, which was the vestige of Primus, that was once the avatar of the Great Chain of Being, who helped Aaron DeCaneth and House Caneth develop the Mass Disjunction and create the Warforged in the first place. That all of these amazing advances created with the help of Primus probably can't be recreated without the presence of Primus in some manner on the material plane.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So this week we're talking about narrative control. That sounds very technical. So Shane, like, what exactly is that?
So it's a word that you'll see thrown around a lot when you discuss game design, but it's basically, it describes who at the table is exerting their influence over the characters, the narrative, and the world.
Obviously, the loudest person at the table, right?
Ideally, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if you have a table with equally voiced people, then what?
Some sort of power sharing agreement?
Well, we can introduce rules for that. We say characters, but we mean both the player characters and the non-player characters, right? Mm-hmm. Who is controlling what's happening in our joined imaginations?
You know, this is a game of shared storytelling, so sometimes you're the one holding the spirit baton.
All right, so let's make it into a useful model, right? Monty Cook proposed there's three axes. There's the GM, there are the players, and then there are the rules. So if you think of, like, what does a game look like if the control is in the extreme, right? So if the control of the game, of the world, of the story is entirely owned by the rules, you're basically playing a war game. That's what chainmail was before D&D existed.
Yeah, or even, like, you know, a traditional board game. Like, we're not making any rules here. We just roll the dice and Monopoly says this is what you do.
This is what happens. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then if you look at traditional RPGs like D&D, GURPS, those sorts of things, they lean much more towards the GM and a little bit towards the rules controlling the narrative.
Yeah, players are there to experience the story. Things happen to them.
The players control themselves, but the result of everything they do is basically determined by the GM's interpretation of a die roll. And then you get into very narrative games like Fiasco, where notably there's no GM at all, and it's entirely the player's decision. The rules barely have any influence whatsoever outside of rough approximations of the order that discussions happen, the way that scenes get set.
Yeah, and if everyone agrees and you want to change any of those, you just do.
Yep. Lots of Fiasco games fall apart in that last act because who cares? It's Fiasco. We're making a fun story, right?
Also, we're all drunk.
That helps, yeah. And then you've got a whole bunch of games that fall along a spectrum somewhere in the middle, right? So you've got things like Fate, which has lots of input from the players, but also some pretty firm mechanics. Got games like Cypher System, where the GM never rolls any dice, so it's always in the hands of the players, and the GM is just sort of facilitating.
Yeah, and you've got something like Dungeon World, where world building occurs as a communal activity at the table.
Exactly. In all of those games, right, there's more narrative control in the hands of the players than there are in those sort of traditional RPGs like D&D.
And I think this is a trend that we're seeing in the industry as a whole. Chainmail obviously is very old, and it began almost entirely rules focused. And then you introduce more kinds of control that aren't necessarily dictated by the creator of the game. Now the GM has more control, and now we're moving into an era where we're experimenting more with player control, or even entirely player control.
Yeah.
Will it swing back the other direction? Yeah, I think it'll go back and forth.
I mean, we're seeing that, right? That's what OSR is, mm-hmm. is kind of a swing back towards that traditional style of the GM dictates more than the players.
And there's not a right or wrong way to do any of this. No particular game is better or worse because of where they fall in these axes. It's definitely up to your group and what kind of game you like.
Yeah. There are trends, though, right? Even within the same game, across different groups. Have you played in a railroaded D&D game where the GM had, like, all of the narrative control and you were just along for the ride?
Some people love that.
I mean, sometimes for con games, I love that.
Yeah.
Give me, that way I get a great story, right? I don't go screw it up by trying to be a player.
Some people hate that, particularly in long campaigns.
Right,
you know,
right.
I want to be able to make decisions. I want to have some impact on the story.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's important to know where you fall on the spectrum, where your group does, and where the game that you're playing does.
Yeah. And even within, like, who calls for a role at the table,
mm-hmm.
right? Sometimes when we're playing, the GM goes, okay, cool, give me a deception check. And other times the GM goes, that's a great lie. That works. No role necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the player makes a statement, you know, tries to tell a lie and goes, I'm rolling deception. And then we live with that result, even if the DM wouldn't have required it, right? You just take control of it as a player, and then you work to interpret those results together. So even within a single game of D&D, different groups and different GMs will have different tolerances for where that narrative control lies.
Okay, so it's not difficult to play a game where the rules dictate everything that happens. So really, we're talking about games that give more narrative control to players.
And by the way, if you're a GM who's using every single rule to interpret every single role, you're a computer. I'm impressed. But that just isn't the use case for probably 99.9% of games, because GMs are people.
Yeah, I'd say it's actually one of the mistakes that new GMs make is trying to apply the rules to every single thing that happens all the time.
Yeah, you play Baldur's Gate and then you think, oh, cool, like I can be the computer in Baldur's Gate. And then you slowly realize that I can do more than just be the computer.
The computer hates this game.
Yeah.
It's just doing fog of war calculations.
So let's say you want to experiment with giving more narrative control to your players, because there are some real benefits to that, right? Games like Savage Worlds just have whole subsystems that hand it over to the players and the players go, like the montage system for traveling. We talked about Cypher System, where the GM isn't rolling any dice. Star Wars, those narrative dice, like that narrative means you have control.
Yeah, the Fantasy Flight, Edge of the Empire.
Right.
You have to interpret every single die roll.
Yeah, exactly. There's lots of permutations of those die rolls. So what are some of the benefits of handing the reins over to the players?
Well, it definitely increases engagement at the table. You know, since players are owning more of the action, they are paying attention to what's happening. They're paying attention to what might happen in the future. And because everyone could potentially get a chance to influence the action on their own, it really brings in people who maybe otherwise it would have sort of sat back and not really come up with anything.
Yeah, and in a similar vein, you have a similar investment in the world building as well, right? Because you're more invested in the world if you're getting a chance to help create the world, to define it, to build your story.
Yeah, it's pretty rare that you're going to play in a setting where every single person at the table is super invested in it and loves that setting and is really familiar with it and is like, yeah, yeah, let's do this. Maybe Darkson at our table.
Well, yeah. Our table is an exception.
But when everyone has a hand in developing the map that you are playing on, we're figuring out where the city is, what's in that city, what's its name, where are the bodies of water, what mountain range do we walk over? Eventually, there's a point where everyone can point to something on that map and go, hey, I did that.
Yeah, that was my place. I made that swamp.
Or you. Oh, you came up with that. That was awesome. Or I hated that, but man, that was memorable.
Right. I think as a GM, it's also easier to prep overall. You don't need to build out such ornate plans that sometimes you need to do if you're controlling everything yourself. You can focus on just challenging the players and sort of let them figure out their solutions and build the world and narrative in the direction that they want to go.
Yeah, I think in general, it does require less prep. You will need to contend with more improvisation on your part, though. But I think that's always a good exercise.
Oh, yeah. Prepping is different. We'll talk about that in a bit. But I think overall, it's less to prepare.
Yeah. But there are some drawbacks to giving players more narrative control. I mean, for one, there are some players, you know, wallflowers, casual gamers, people who are new, who maybe don't want the responsibility of creating either the world or deciding what's going to happen next.
Yeah, and if you're really in depth in your role play, like if you're the method actor kind of player, that responsibility over the narrative overall, over the whole story, can really distract from your role play, right? You can't get into your character and how your character deals with things if you're having to look at the other few people at the table and figure out what's best for everybody.
Yeah, like why am I the one deciding what's on the other side of this door? I don't know.
Right. And then it's more work, mm-hmm. right? You've got to keep more things in mind and focused on more things if you're a player with narrative control. So sometimes that turns people off because they don't want to have to do that. They don't want to come up with these spontaneous ideas on the fly. They want to be told and they want to react to it.
At the same time, you really risk having an unequal spotlight when some players are really invested in having that narrative control and others aren't. Or when everyone is equally invested, but some people are just more comfortable or louder or more experienced with this kind of thing.
Or even just more focused on their own character.
Selfish, I think, is what you're saying.
I don't want to say selfish because
I'll say it.
It might not be a negative, right? It might just be not remaining actively aware of the other broader narratives that you're just driving kind of your own character forward. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can overshadow the other characters as well.
Yeah, it could be. I'm taking responsibility for what happens in my character. You should also be doing the same with your character.
Exactly, right. So keep in mind, if you're playing more player narrative-driven games, right, prepping is going to be different. As we mentioned before, you can improv more. You don't need to worry about planning all the things, mm-hmm. but you don't have to worry about planning things that the players will like because they'll just create that stuff for themselves. Like, if they want political intrigue in their game, they're going to find an NPC to give them political intrigue. That's sort of how the game works.
Of course, at the same time, if you're not playing a game where there's no prep necessary, like if you're not playing Fiasco, then when you have that player introduce an NPC, well, now you've basically got to run that NPC.
Yeah.
And you got to be ready for that.
Right. You probably want to be focused on challenges. Have questions ready that you can ask the players versus having solutions and answers to those questions.
Put the onus back on them. If the point is for them to have more control, well, people who aren't necessarily used to that may come up with an initial idea, but you may then need to prompt them to flesh it out.
Right. Or take their initial idea and expound upon that for them, mm-hmm. depending on how involved your players are.
So what are some good ways to do that when you're actually at the table?
Well, start small. So I think the simplest one and the one that lots of tables do and maybe don't even realize that this is giving players narrative control is ask, how do you kill it? When you reduce something to 0 hit points, just narrate your kill.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of GMs out there who sort of take pride in like coming up with an interesting description every time someone does drop an enemy. But consider just sort of seeding that occasionally to your players and give them the opportunity to try out coming up with things that aren't mechanically going to impact the game.
Another cool thing you can do on top of that, though, right, is, hey, you described the absolute mess of blood and gore and everything that has happened from this decapitation. It sprays blood in the eyes, and now his friend, who's also attacking you, is attacking with disadvantage. Very small twist, but a benefit for a character who's creative.
And then you have other people seeing that happen.
And trying to, yeah, I know. But you want to incentivize the behavior that you want to see, right? If you want the players to take more control, give them a reason to.
Aside from just narrating a kill, you can also have players set the scene. There are six bandits. Tell me what they look like.
Right. Or there's six bandits. One of them stands out to you. What stands out about that bandit?
Games like Phoenix Dawn Command actually do this mechanically with something called the Torch, which is a list of objects or phenomena in a particular scene that players can get bonuses for interacting with in an interesting way.
Yeah, in Fate, it would be like aspects, but you set them up at the beginning of every scene and then you're passing them around as the initiative order moves.
You can also put the onus of creating entire locations or NPCs on the players themselves. I think this works really well in maybe a large city where the party is going to, you know, they say, we're going to go to a tavern, we're going to check out local rumors. Well, one tavern is much the same as any other. So since they're going to pick which tavern they're going to, just let them describe what it looks like.
And then as the GM, you can always come in on top and add the important details that you need, right? So if there is the shadowy figure in the corner booth who's doing some shady dealings under the table, well, they can describe the tavern perfectly, and then you add in that shady figure.
Yeah, if it needs a cellar, it has a cellar.
Right. Or, you know, maybe one of the characters that they described could really work as that shadowy figure, and then you just take those characteristics and ascribe them to that NPC, right? Now it's that shifty-looking dwarf instead of the shadowy figure.
Yeah, that person you just described, they remove their hat.
Right.
And they walk over to you.
Exactly. That's almost a reward in itself for the players who took the time to create that character, and now you're already using it for them.
Yeah, we've talked about before, like, it is so difficult to come up with people's names or, like, how tall they are or distinguishing facial features.
Yeah.
Let your players do it. It's great.
You've got five people working on it instead of just you. So another trick that I like is the montage. Not just a way to pass time, but also helps you build out the world.
Yeah, I think this is a thing that we initially borrowed from Savage Worlds. They have some downtime mechanics. People narrate what they did in a loose kind of way, and then everyone sort of joins in with, oh yeah, and then this thing happened, and well, here's how I responded to that.
Right.
It really lets the players fill in, you know, long swaths of time that happen either between adventures or, you know, before an adventure started. And you don't need to really do anything to prep that. You know, you give certain confines, like you're beginning here at this next place, tell me how you got there. And that prevents the players from saying, oh, well, we went to a different plane, and then we ended up in the City of Brass. Well, you didn't end up in the City of Brass because you ended up here. How'd you get here?
And then we won the lottery. And now we have lots of gold.
So great. Tell me how you lost it.
Right.
Because you don't have it.
Because, yeah, you know your beginning and your end state. So you can do whatever you want in between. The reason it isn't a net zero, the reason it's not, you know, like an old sitcom episode, is that those characters and activities and places that are created through that montage, you can then use later.
Yeah, they all exist now.
Right. You can tie them back into whatever the story is already doing.
You use this to good effect in our Rogue Trader game. We had several long time skips, like multiple years, in between game arcs. Lots of things happen on a void ship skirting the edge of the Imperium and dodging Xenos over the course of 8 years.
Yeah, when you're a pirate.
Yeah. You could have, I guess, rolled a bunch of dice and like told us exactly what happened. But I think it was much more interesting where we basically sort of had a session, you know, 9.5, which is like a redo of a session zero, where we're coming back into the arc. We all sit down. We don't necessarily roll a ton of dice, but we collectively determine not how we got together in the first place, but what we've been doing in the meantime.
Right. I basically told you guys in advance, hey, this is what we're doing this session, right? We're going to kind of advance the timeline a bit. Here's where you left and here's where you get to. So think about the types of things you did. And then I brought a couple tools to help facilitate that. So I basically built a table of suggestions and I numbered them. And there were 10 of them. So everybody decided, hey, you know what? Let's just roll dice. Like, I'll roll a die. And when this says, you know, we monopolize the trade of a vicious Xeno species that we sold into the fighting pits. All right. Tell me all about it. Tell me where it came from. Tell me what that species was. Tell me what you had to do. What was the challenge that you overcame as you did that? Right. And then, so I set up sort of a, what did you win with? What was a setback? Kind of who did you piss off in the process? Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of things. And then I could pull all of those in as we set up our next arc.
Yeah, I like that everything kind of had two sides. If it was a good one, or the story that the player told was like very positive and good, then there was some sort of negative consequence. And if it was a bad one, then actually there was some sort of benefit that you had, that the party had reaped because of that as well.
Right.
And that introduced a bunch of new plot hooks and things that we were aware of because, you know, they had happened to our characters.
Yeah. Well, you had the Inquisition on your tail for a while.
Yep.
And then you spent other montage elements trying to solve that problem so that I wouldn't carry it forward.
Yeah, we were like, oh, let's definitely get rid of that one.
Right. And then I think you ended up with a trade war against another rogue trader
mm-hmm.
who then became kind of a driving factor in the next arc.
Yeah.
You were trying to settle bad blood, basically.
It figured pretty prominently.
Right.
I do like, and I think this is probably the best way to go about it, is that, you know, we switch back and forth between campaigns and DMs. You know, we'll do 6 weeks or 10 weeks and then switch to another one and then back. And these were the sessions that reintroduced us back into Rogue Trader after playing a different game. So it was also a way to sort of recap, you know, what happened last time. And then we weren't coming into it trying to be like, wait, what exactly did we do and who are we again?
Right. The input that I had into that was just making sure that I had something to latch on to for the next arc.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know what the next arc was going to be at that point. I was hoping you would give me NPCs and plot hooks, and you guys did.
Yeah, and then you had a week to prepare.
And because you spent so much time fixing your Inquisition problem, it told me you didn't want to deal with the Inquisition. So naturally, I gave you the Inquisition. Just introduced it from the side.
We really need to use more reverse psychology on shit.
Right. And then lots of games do this already, but they're usually easy mechanics to port over. Use some sort of metagame mechanic that introduced direct control to the PCs. So I'm thinking Fate Chips or Bennies from Savage Worlds or Lightside Points in Edge of the Empire, or even D&D now has Inspiration.
Mm-hmm. We talked about this actually way back in episode one, where D&D doesn't have this mechanic, but I basically, you know, gave everyone a poker chip and said, you can cash this in and we'll do a quick flashback that can mildly retcon whatever situation you're in.
Yeah, it's great because now not only do players feel safer in taking risks and doing cool things because they've got a little bit of help in their pocket, but they also have that natural feeling of control too. Like, I can spend this and get something for it.
And it sort of frees you up as a GM to be like, all right, we can go all out here because they've got a little bit of a cushion. And if they're smart, then they'll use it well.
Right.
And you can use this in any system.
Yeah. You just have to find the right bump, right? If it's a re-rolling a die or adding a die to a pool or maybe even re-rolling a whole pool, those types of things work great. Though I will say, a lot of times they're baked into systems and not very well utilized at the table. I know we struggled with that with Inspiration mm-hmm. in D&D 5e. It wasn't natural to the flow of D&D, so we didn't use it a whole lot.
Yeah, and it was advantage on one die roll one time. It was sort of like, is it really worth it using it for this one thing? Maybe I should wait till I really, really need it. So it turned out that people just didn't really spend it.
Right.
But I think part of that was, you know, I needed to hand it out more often. So as soon as you spend it, there's an opportunity to get it again.
Yeah, you've got to create an economy of it as the mm-hmm. GM. And that's core to Fate. And that's one of the things people really struggle with Fate, is that you've got to be passing these back and forth. Once the players know that this isn't the last Inspiration they're ever going to have, this isn't the last Fate point they're ever going to have, they will make in-character decisions that are bad for them, knowing that there's a benefit at the end, right? Hey, do a cool thing. Play up your flaw. Get Inspiration. Now when I really need it, I've got it.
Yeah, it's one thing I like about the Edge of the Empire system is the light side points that are sort of used in a similar way. They are shared between the GM and the players. And so when the players spend one, the GM gains one and vice versa. So there's sort of this constant back and forth of who has the pool.
But that can run into the exact same problem, right? Where if the GM in Edge of the Empire isn't spending his dark side points, then the players are very hesitant to spend light side because they don't want to load up the GM and just get wrecked all at one time.
So the rules specifically say, you know, explain to everyone at the table that these are not meant to be hoarded. That's not in the spirit of these points.
Right. So that's important. You've got to communicate that and then also enact it at the table.
Yeah.
This happened for us. We played Mutants and Masterminds, which has basically a fate point system, a hero point system.
Mm-hmm. And they refresh every session, I believe.
Every session, yeah. Or when you do something amazing, yeah. Basically. And so I got into one of those situations. I don't think you were here for the last...
I missed the finale, yeah.
Yeah, so in the last session, we were... It's a superhero game, right? But we ended up having to travel into a villain's dreams to fight them inside their own head, kind of Inception style.
Very cool.
The villain had tons of control within the dream. Once they realized we were there, they could really manipulate things around us, and we had a way to avoid that, and I had already used mine. So my character was Sarcastra, who used basically cutting words as attacks and mocked everybody at the table, but especially her enemies, to do real damage, emotional damage.
Just a brutal, mean girl.
That's who she was. She was also an EDM DJ.
Yes, that's what I said. A brutal, mean girl.
So I spent whatever it was that let me avoid being manipulated by the dreams and then insulted the villain, and the villain just closed my mouth permanently. And when your sarcasm-based is your special ability, that becomes a problem because I couldn't do anything. So during this dream fight, the villain was having these memories that we were able to witness that kind of gave us insight into her background, and it was basically problems with her father and never being good enough for him. And we see the first scene of this, and then I literally pulled out my iPhone, because my character has an iPhone, and played a song on my turn to mock her for her daddy issues. And so the GM gave me a fate point for that, or a power point, or a hero point, whatever they're called. And then I was like, yes, I'm doing this forever now. Like, I will spend all of my points because I get them back when I do funny things.
Now, I hesitate to say this, but another way that you can give more control over to your players is to refrain from using a battle map. Now, I'm a GM who really loves putting together elaborate maps, beautiful maps. There's something about rolling it out and people going, oh, or being slightly terrified or trepidatious about what they're about to face because they can see the terrain.
They see this looks bad. Yeah.
But it does bind you to what is then on the map, especially if it's pre-printed and not just sort of drawn with dry erase markers. They're a helpful visual aid, but you know, if you are too detailed, then a certain kind of player will just focus on what they see on the table rather than what they can come up with in their head.
Yeah, I think the classic example of this is like, I swing from the chandelier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no chandelier on the map, right? So of course you swing from the chandelier because that's awesome. But if you're not in that mindset of what's on the ceiling, because I'm staring top down at a battle map, it can be hard to remember that there's other things in the room that aren't necessarily represented.
Right. I think like the traditional bar fight, there's so many battle maps of bars, but it is so difficult to imagine what's going on once all the tables that are on the map
are flipped.
Right. Yeah. Flipped or like smashed into kindling. Yep. And you know, I grab a chair. Well, I just sort of need to imagine a chair, but there's no chair here on the map.
Right. Yeah. So like, where's the nearest chair? It's like, there's chairs everywhere. You know, it's like that guy got sent out through a window.
Yeah. And if you want your players to be able to say cool things like, well, okay, I rush up and I like hit them both. Maybe that's totally fine. But if you look on the map, they're actually 7 squares away and not 6 squares away. So they can't actually do it.
Right.
But like, who cares?
Especially for encounters that aren't going to be tactical challenges, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's a place for the heavily tactical challenge. If it's going to be kind of a more narrative challenge, then I would adopt more of a theater of the mind kind of approach.
I think about the Deck of Many Things when the party drew the skull card and they were elves sort of infiltrating the Vol compound and fighting like dragons and undead and all kinds of crazy abominations. I wanted that to be just this total scrum with like spells and just crazy things going around everywhere. So we did that theater of the mind. I didn't put together a battle map, even though I often do pretty elaborate battle maps, just because I wanted everything to be as haywire as possible. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to put enough stuff on the map and keep it all straight to maintain that sort of sense of immersion.
Yeah, I am confident that my memory of that encounter is nothing like your memory of that encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And yet mine is equally vivid and just as memorable.
And like, we agree on all the salient points.
Right, right. So another thing you can do, and this is easily the most extreme
/ controversial,
let the players fudge their die rolls.
Oh, don't worry. I always do. just when I roll stats.
Right, right. Yeah, I know. It's kind of a longstanding tradition how many 18/100s got rolled in second edition. The GM has always sort of rolled in secret, right? So that they had the ability to fudge. You could give the same option to the players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is emblematic of having narrative control. I can determine what the dice say.
So if you're going to introduce the player fudge, I would start very small because that could easily get out of hand and then you could end up playing Calvin Ball.
Which is great in its own right.
Is also probably not a role-playing game.
Oh, well, it can be.
So the Angry GM actually suggested this a long time ago, that at his table, he lets the players roll death-saving throws in secret. They make the roll, but they never have to reveal the outcome of the roll publicly. So they decide whether or not they pass or fail, and they can leave it up to the dice, or they can decide, no, I don't want my character to die, or I'm just going to kill my character. I don't care.
That's a very big type of role to cede to the players. It's a very impactful kind of control to decide whether or not your character lives or dies. Because it is, in many games, sort of the central tension of the game. Do I live or do I die?
The one thing about character death, right, is that a lot of times players feel like this is the right time, right? Like this is an okay ending for this character.
Mm-hmm.
And if the dice don't cooperate, you're in a weird spot. So I'm okay with it, especially if you don't have players that are just running headlong into death because they're not afraid of it anymore, right? Which is certainly a fair concern. So I don't know. I think that's it's a good starting point, right? If you're looking for something more substantial. So Ishan, where do you fall in the spectrum? What's your preference as a player?
I definitely veer farther to the player control end than traditional D&D, you know, where the GM creates everything based on the roles and the rules, and players only have control over, you know, sort of their internal monologue, basically. But I like very mechanical ways to introduce more narrative control for the players. So, you know, these small subsystems of, you know, having fate chips. I also really like to use these kinds of tools for initial setup, because that's sort of a fun exercise as a GM to, you know, throw yourself headlong into improvisation. So I'm thinking, for example, we are beginning a campaign or beginning a session and we begin in media res.
Mm-hmm.
So roll initiative. You don't know where you are and I'm not going to tell you where you are.
Right.
Okay. Who's going first? You. Tell me what the room looks like.
Yep.
Okay. Who's going next? You. Tell me who you're fighting. You, hey, you get to actually do a thing.
Right.
Give me another detail about this situation.
Right. Remind me why you're fighting here again?
Yeah. Who sent you here? And then, you know, collectively, we sort of do that. It doesn't have to happen with the entire story, but in particularly episodic campaigns that maybe go for a long time, but, you know, each individual session doesn't necessarily drive the plot forward, I think it's a nice way to sort of keep things interesting and keep people on their toes. What about you? You've played a lot more games than I have where players have ultimate narrative control.
Well, that's true. So before I talk about my opinion, I want to point out something that you said that's really important, which is that giving up narrative control does not require you to lose mechanics.
Mm.
Like you can have full mechanics of your game and build mechanical ways to add narrative control on the player side. So I think that's important, right? Is that you don't have to give up your crunchy game just to give more control to the players. But yeah, so personally, I prefer probably something more middle ground than you, because I do like when the GM has a vision. I just like to be able to write the parts that are really important to me. Right? And I know that's kind of waffling on the answer, because it's probably impossible as a GM to read the mind of every player at the table. So that's also why I like to play really small games. Like my perfect group for me is 2 or 3 players. And I say that as we're currently in a group of 7 players. But, you know, I like to have that type of thing where the GM can have a very vivid vision of what the campaign is and who the characters and what the world is. But when it's important to that character, right, that player gets a chance to really drive the story.
Yeah, I think there are definitely times when Brand took the reins more, and it wasn't necessarily in-game, but even just okay, here are the kinds of things that I want to happen. And then other times just sort of totally relinquished control and was like, this is not important to me. Yeah. I will go along with whatever you guys want to do.
That's the hallmark of me as a player, though. It's just like, guys, this isn't important to my character. I don't give a fuck.
That's very Sarcastra.
Right. That actually was half of what Sarcastra did. And then what made her a bad character was that it just meant I was distracting after that.
I put my headphones on. Do whatever.
But unfortunately, it was more like, I don't care about this. I just make snarky quips in the background, delaying the whole process.
Someday you'll play a character who isn't selfish. Someday.
Hey.
Maybe.
Don't talk to me about Brand being selfish.
Oh, my country. Oh, my religion.
Oh, killing my god.
There are lots of dead gods, okay? History is littered with them.
Oh, dear. Do you hear that, Ishan?
That is me succeeding on my death saving throw again.
Oh, nice.
No, I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I believe you this time. But just in case you failed, let's move on to the Character Creation Forge. Before we do that, we can talk about how our listeners get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit into 140 characters at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
So what do we have in the Character Creation Forge this week?
It is the Master Illusionist.
I don't believe you.
This is a character who takes narrative control. In-game.
Very much. Or at least control of what other people see in the narrative.
I will create a thing from my own mind and insert it into your mind. From the name, you can determine. It's a wizard who takes advantage of the perceptions and the conjured misperceptions of other people to exert their influence.
Yeah, it's the most deceitful of the wizard archetypes, right? It's the one who lets people see what they want to see and what they fear and what they hope for, even when it's not real. So this build is Illusionist Wizard 18, Warlock 2.
Have we done a wizard warlock before? A wizlock?
I don't think we've done a wizlock.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons we picked this spread, was we were like, hey, that's unique.
If you have recently listened to our back catalog and we have done a wizlock, please let me know. At Mundangerous.
So what is Warlock in here for? We're only dipping two. There's got to be something we're specifically gunning for.
Well, you're mainly a wizard, so you're going to max your intelligence. So it's not for Eldritch Blast, which is going to shoot off of your charisma.
With two levels, my guess is we're basically going for a particular invocation.
We are going for an invocation. It is Misty Visions, which lets you cast Silent Image at will.
That's very nice, because that is a first level spell. It's really tough to get first level spells at will in 5th edition.
It is. It's actually the benefit of going to Wizard 18 is a first and second level spell at will.
We get this with just a 2-level dip.
2-level dip.
Yeah.
So the Illusionist at level 2 gets Improved Minor Illusion, which is your bread and butter. You can create images and sounds from a single cast of the spell. With Silent Image and Improved Minor Illusion, you can do quite a bit at a very low level.
At level 6, you get Malleable Illusion. So for those long-term illusory spells, you can change them in the middle. It prevents you from having to recast things. You can just make it different.
And this is where you want to be clever as a player. And you want to cast things that, when you change them, will be impactful, right? You want to create illusions that are brought to life by their changing, not that are more suspect by their changing.
Mm-hmm. You want to skate along the edges of verisimilitude.
Exactly.
At 10, you get Illusory Self. Once per short rest, you're able to create a double that sort of takes an attack for you. That's nice. But the real thing that you want is at level 14, Illusory Reality. And this is what combos with Silent Image. Every time you cast an illusion of first level or higher, which Silent Image is, you can take one thing in that illusion and make it real for a minute. And you can cast Silent Image at will.
Now, you can't do damage or direct harm to anything, but there are plenty of things you can do. And you can definitely stretch the limits of direct harm. The example in the book, actually, is create an illusory bridge across a chasm and then make it real for a minute. Now, let's say you did that and then stopped concentrating on the spell when your enemies followed you across that bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't do them direct harm. That's the fall.
Or what if you're up against someone who's very skeptical and they just don't trust anything you're doing? Maybe you've proven to them that you're not really trustworthy.
Right.
Well, if they are constantly trying to disbelieve your illusions, it's going to help you sell it if they bump into something that is actually real and solid.
Like, say, the ace up your sleeve. So at 17, we get 9th level spells, which, as a wizard, you get Wish and True Polymorph and all the usual game-breaking things you get at level 17.
I mean, if the purpose is to take things that you imagine either in your mind or in a dream and you want to make it real, Wish is what you're looking for.
Wish works for me.
I wish this were real.
I wish I had friends. Keep in mind, you'll also have access to Simulacrum, which gives you extra illusory nonsense to play with.
You can have 2 things that are real all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think you can have 20, right? You just keep casting.
Keep casting, yeah. Simulacrum. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, because they can do it at will.
Right.
They don't need any spell slots. And then at 18, we stick with Wizard. This level is much more up to you, but you can choose a 1st and 2nd level spell to cast without using a spell slot. Now, it needs to be prepared, so it counts as a prepared spell, but when you use it, it doesn't exhaust a slot, which is great. You know, you already have Silent Image, so maybe your 1st level spell is Shield? It's like you avoid the 1st attack with your illusion. The 2nd one, you use a shield. And then 2nd level spells, there's a handful of utility ones. There's also invisibility. I like that idea as an illusionist.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Who cares if, like, I reappear when I attack or cast a spell? I'll just cast it again.
And, like, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? You cast the spell, but if you disappear and then use your abilities to manipulate the spell, like making something real or causing the image to move,
you're an illusory puppeteer.
So, Ishan, what's your backstory?
Big hippie.
Okay.
Yeah. Enjoys the trance, maybe through psychedelic substances. And this is why they actually begin Warlock. They create a pact with an otherworldly being because they're really trying to explore, you know, what is the nature of reality? What is real and what is illusion? And the visions that they see when, you know, they're imbibing particular kinds of herbal soup, or visiting the oracle above the crack in the ground with the volcanic fumes. Are those real? Are they actual prophecies? Are they visions from on high? Are they just created in the mind? Who knows? And in fact, when not experiencing those things, is this real right now? Like I said, big hippie.
Oh my God. Your character is like the most annoying stoner in history.
But then gets down to studying, right? Because they want to understand this on a fundamental philosophical level.
Career student, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, obviously. Sage background.
Say no more. He's a PhD candidate. I get it.
In a world with magic, they're experimenting with taking things that are actually just created in the imagination and making them actually physically real. This is their journey.
It's like Walt Disney.
If he could create Mickey Mouse as a horrifying abomination for 1 minute at a time.
Hate to break it to you. Have you ever been to Disney World?
Oh, God. It's already begun. All right. What is your master illusionist? How do they get there?
He's a hedge wizard. Not particularly good. Not particularly well trained.
Oh, God. He probably hangs out with my character.
Yeah, probably. Not particularly disciplined. Yeah, he's from a region where magic is rare, and so it's feared. And so his background is he used his magic to pull a prank and basically got shunned from his homeland for it. It's like, you, get out of here. Yeah, I'm thinking it's like he made it look like the tavern was on fire and it like caused a big emergency in town. Everybody like pitched in a bunch of resources. Then it turned out like everything was fine, but you know.
Hilarious.
Yeah, I got you good.
I made you eat your parents.
So he gets shunned, or he gets kicked out of his village, and he basically wanders, right? And he gets by with his tricks, maybe makes a shady pact with a fey or something like that on his way. Yeah, straightforward stuff. Finds an adventuring party and puts his talents to good use.
What happens to his original village when he gets Wish?
I wish they liked me. But I like this because I think this works well for like a non-traditional wizard race, like a half-orc wizard, for example, maybe with like an outlander background, because it makes sense for a society that doesn't cultivate a wizard tradition to have that kind of screw-up mage, right?
Mm-hmm. They don't have a mentor to teach them how it's actually done.
Right.
Or the mores involved in dabbling in illusions.
Right. All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
So we've got 2 reviews today. This is Brilliant Stuff, 5 stars, by JD and a bunch of numbers. Knowledgeable, informative, and fun.
I like that they didn't include the Oxford comma as a journalist.
Well, I think the intent of the sentence was clear.
I agree. The next one is called Great RPG Listening by Liger Zero. This show is a great listen. Their discussion of building characters has helped me think of interesting new ways to play my home D&D campaign. A definite can't miss for any RPG fan. That means you, friends.
Yeah, thank you both for the kind words. And we appreciate all of the feedback. A lot of this came from our contest that we ran. So thanks everybody for participating. It's good to have reviews to read on the air again.
Whew.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about epic destinies.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building a psychic warrior.
Well, that's it for episode 64 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.